We the People, brought to you by the Reading Tea Party. We're live from KCNR 1460, home of Shasta Reading, the home of Free Fire Media. We the People this morning is brought to you by Bill Miller Auto Transport, Pearson Excavating, and North State Consultants. Those are three of our really great patriots that are very supportive of the show. We want to shout out to them. Thank you very much for supporting our show. And definitely contact those guys if you're in need of their services, and you can find out more about them on ReadingTeaParty.com. Good morning, Aaron and Chandler.
Good morning.
We are all here on this kind of rainy morning.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about our sponsors, and I thought, isn't it funny? What a unique area we live in.
Yeah.
Let's see. We have a guy who takes cars all over the country, or actually things with wheels, I should say.
Anything that has four wheels, basically.
Dan Pearson's an excavating company, so, you know, if you need a hole somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. Yep. I guess he might fill one
in,
too.
Or a driveway or a home pad, or he does all kinds of stuff.
All that stuff. And then if you want to keep all your money, you call North State Consultants and have them do your taxes.
Yeah. So we run the gamut on the services offered by our Patriots. So last night was fun, Aaron.
Last night was super fun. And
we went to
Christmas for the troops.
Yes. Yeah, there were a whole bunch of us there.
We had... that room was packed. We were just guessing how many people were there. We figured about 300 people.
Mm-hmm.
300 people packed 500
boxes.
But when 300 people pack 500 boxes and they get to just put the stuff in random and pack them, I think it took like 2 hours.
Yeah, it was a blast. It's my first time. And the thing that really attracted me to doing it, in addition to my love for our veterans and our troops, was the fact that it's such a family event. You know, they serve a spaghetti feed put on by the Sons of Italy, and they have music and all kinds of stuff going on.
And
lots and lots of kids.
Yep.
And, you know, not to get too deep, but folks, if you really want your kids to understand the greatness of this country, you can't just talk about it. You have to show it to them. And we had the Color Guard there last night, and a lot of veterans and active military in uniform, and you don't have to tell your kids. They'll see it for themselves.
Yeah, what a great idea, though, that you're going to send a box of stuff to somebody who's not going to be home for Christmas, and I think most of us...
Yeah, I got a little message from my nephew in Iraq this morning on Facebook. Love Facebook. And, he very quickly said, thanks for doing that, you guys. We can't tell you how much the packages from home mean to us.
We had a great time. We were... We're actually borrowing some of the table decorations and
stealing stuff off the wall.
Yeah, okay, we stole stuff off the wall.
All the flags out of the centerpieces went into the boxes for the troops.
We're like, oh, a flag. Hey, there's this gold star. What are we going to do with the gold stars? So
we know that we sent
some gold stars to the troops.
Yeah, yeah.
We figured they should have gold stars.
Yeah. So we have a special guest this morning. We have a young woman. Well, I should say a young lady who... when I was talking about the kids, who was there with us last night, and her name is Nikki, she's 10, and she talked, she was very excited about doing Christmas for the troops last night, and so we might ask her a couple of questions. It's possible she'll be a little shy.
Say hi, Nikki.
Hi.
There you go. We've broken the ice.
Well, she chattered all the way here in the car, so I know she can do it. Anyway, Nikki, tell us a little bit about what you did last night.
Well, they did a raffle drawing, and you would win prizes. And they would fill the packages with candy, Girl Scout cookies, and deodorant.
Everything they need.
Books, CDs, and other CDs.
How many people were there?
I would say about 300.
Mm-hmm. A lot of kids?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was your favorite part?
Probably the raffling, maybe when you were packaging the box. That was fun.
Now, didn't they have, like, hundreds of Christmas cards for people to sign?
They had hundreds of Christmas cards. My last card, when I wanted to put it in the box, I saw the box was filled with cards.
So you and your two sisters sat down at a table, and I think between the two of you, the three of you, how many cards do you think you signed?
Well, Sarah, my sister Sarah, made 43.
Holy cow.
Angie made 9, and I made 37 or 36.
That's cool. So when we packaged up the boxes, they threw in a bunch of Christmas cards from you guys.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. Had you ever been to that before?
Well, it's either I haven't or I don't remember.
Okay. I guess when you're 10, it could go either way.
Yeah. Definitely. Definitely.
All
well,
right.
We're glad you had a good time. So we're going to go ahead and chat a little bit about our upcoming guest.
Yeah, we're going to, let's just go right to Kevin. We just wanted to give you a little bit of information about him. Kevin, we wanted him to come up and speak, but he's a busy fellow. But he has written a book called Instanity. Now, I'll let you, let Kevin tell you why he chose that title, because I don't want to mess that up. But one of the things he has on here in his clip about the book that I really thought was interesting, it's a thoughtful analysis presented through multiple vantage points. Mr. McGarry illuminates why and how the state of instant and selective insanity has permeated the current political spectrum. And I think a lot of people listening to this program are going, you know, I'm all good on the insanity part of it, you know?
Yeah. You know, and I've got a really interesting, and we can do it when we come back, but I have an interesting quote from an actual Tea Party president in the Bay Area who talks a little bit about the book. So we can do that when we come back. Or
all right. I'm going to take a little shrimpy break, and then we're going to listen to Mr. McGarry for quite a while. So you should plan your activities now and get
back
on.
Go to the bathroom,
on.
Get your coffee,
yep.
And settle
do
in.
Do what you got to do, and we're going to hear from Mr. McGarry. We are on KCNR, 1460 AM, Shasta Redding, the home of Free Fire Media.
Hi. Welcome back to We the People, brought to you by the Redding Tea Party, KCNR, 1460 Shasta Redding. If you do want to call in, the number is 605-4567, or we're streaming live at www.kcnr1460.com.
There you have it. All right, so we are going to get online here with Kevin McGarry. Just as you're listening to him, I want you to know that he also speaks on faith and freedom matters, healthcare matters, socioeconomic matters specifically impacting people of color, education matters, human reproductive matters. How's that for a range? He asked me, well, what do you want me to talk about Sunday morning? I said, you know, when you get up in the morning, why don't you just see what seems most important? So we're going to find out what that is. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We are.
How the good folks up in the northern part of Northern California doing?
We're great.
Well, you know, you can't beat it when you wake up late and you can get, you know, the 10 miles to the radio station in about 12 minutes.
Wow! Awesome.
Yeah, I passed like 3 cars.
Yeah, it's pretty nice here.
So we're pretty much living in a different world than you are.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
There
yeah.
really is no traffic here on Sunday morning.
Hey, so Kevin, what prompted you to name this book what you named it? Because I've had several people ask me.
Yeah, I will. Can I just get to that in a second? First of all, I wanted to thank you all for having me as a guest this morning. I'm really honored to be here, and it's quite a privilege to be able to talk to good patriots up in the northern California area, so I appreciate that. Number two, I wanted to extend a thank you for all that you do for our troops and keeping them on the forefront of your hearts and your prayers as they put everything on the line for us day to day, and for what you did last night. I just personally want to accommodate you for that. It's wonderful.
Thank you. Well, we do love our troops here.
It's really nice that there are so many things for people to plug into mm-hmm. that are projects that are already going, and with the advent of the Tea Party movement, so many projects that really needed volunteers now have an endless supply.
And, you know, our Tea Party movement is made up of probably, at least up in this area, about 60% veterans.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
They get it.
Wow. So
now, back to the book.
Yeah.
You asked a question about what prompted me to title the book Instanity. You know, there's when you look at what's going on right now today in our government, and you look at the mix of leadership that we have there or lack thereof, the only word that I could think of is pure insanity. But I thought, well, perhaps insanity alone is overused and not very focused and needed to refine it a little bit more. Obviously, we're not all insane. We're still doing what we do on a daily basis to take care of ourselves and take care of our family. So naming the book Insanity would have been a little bit not very appropriate. So what I looked at was we're in a state of sort of a selective insanity. So what I mean by that is it's instant and on purpose, and we choose to act what Webster's defines as insanity. We choose to act irrational and illogical at times, and especially when it comes to voting for our representatives in Washington. And so I figured if you put those two words together, instant insanity, and call it instanity, a hybrid word, that perhaps it'll have some, it'll make sense to people, and it'll be catchy enough to really generate some interest.
Absolutely. And when you and I had spoken the other day, I had said, you know, there are so many of us who have relatives and friends who don't understand what's going on, and they think that so much of this is reactionary, so much of this is just a response to this president and the fact that he's a black man, and so that we're all a bunch of crazy racists, and I'm hoping that most of that has gone away.
And don't you think also that there's a misconception that the resistance is all on one party line?
One party line, and that it's only because of this president. I think you've noticed that this has been coming for a long time.
Right. Well, one of the things that really intrigued me about the last election cycle, prior to the one we just had, was I was feeling really uninformed. I think a lot of Americans feel the way I felt prior to writing the book. I really hadn't followed what's happening in our government and overall governance at all. You know, I was marginally involved, but it was not at a level that I felt that I was properly informed or properly educated on issues like, you know, what is the Declaration of Independence? What does it mean? What's the significance of that? What is the Constitution and why is it important today? Didn't feel that I had a good grasp on the social issues, foundationally, fundamentally, what do they mean? How do they impact us as Americans and really, you know, how should I feel about them as supposedly a principled person? And I certainly didn't have a handle on economic issues. So in general, I felt that I personally was uninformed, uneducated, and because of that, I was unprepared to really engage anyone in any issues related to politics, any of the people that we hire and send to Washington, or their respective agendas. So I think most America really feels, or a lot of Americans really feel like I felt, you know, prior to writing the book. And I'm hopeful that because this book is a sort of every man's guide to understanding the cast of characters, personalities, agendas of who we have in Washington today, and perhaps how we should feel about the social issues that are confronting us as a country, that this book would really provide, you know, the foundation, the enough foundation for people to readily understand what's happening right now.
Hey, Kevin, I found a good quote from an East Bay Tea Party president that I'd like to kind of throw out there real quick, if I can, and it sort of describes her impression of your book.
Oh, that would be excellent, yes.
And that is, I'm gonna quote part of a quote, "His book is helping educate the masses about what is really happening in our country. There is a mass dumbing down of the population and a serious lack of knowledge about our Constitution and our rights and where they come from. His book explains how we as a population have been denied the truth about our history."
And I thought
I thought that was a great summary.
That is. That's an excellent summary. You know, really, the book is it's set up in multiple parts. All right, so it helps the reader to orient themselves around how to look at, again, the government and, in general, governance. And in doing that, it takes a, you know, concerted look at the president, takes a, you know, concerted look at Congress, and certainly it delves deeply into the Declaration and Constitution. And in the last part three, the last vantage point, it really does a sort of compare and contrast of the first two vantage points, which is, you know, first vantage point deals with president and Congress and their competencies or incompetencies thereof. The second is the Constitution Declaration. Excuse me. The third really ties it all together and sort of deconstructs the first two vantage points from the perspective of our faith foundations. So it takes a look at our faith foundations and really helps the reader orient themselves around, you know, what's happening today in comparison to our faith foundations and how does that all play out and how potentially how we should feel about some of these social issues and in relation to faith and those types of things. So it I really do think that it gives a comprehensive look for people who are just now waking up and trying to get engaged and really trying to understand what's happening. The fact is we've had massive and unprecedented change over the past. It's not just this administration.
Right. That's really important for people to know.
They need to separate themselves from this particular administration and kind of go back a little bit.
Right. So it's been happening for decades, but the rapidity of change, the pace of change is really has really accelerated, especially with this administration. So the turmoil within and around our government, with the acceleration of new people coming in and new plans and new agendas, and obviously there's more risk to our sovereignty, and especially when you look at our debt and spending. Which is going to fundamentally impact our freedom and the possibilities that we can have a successful future and future generations can have a successful future. So there's a lot going on that we really need to wake up to quickly, and this book helps with that in I think a nonpartisan way. Yes, it is critical, but it is critical towards certain individuals in and around this administration. However, it does it in a very rational, logical, methodical, fairly objective way. This is not a hit piece against our president.
Right.
But what I do want to orient the readers around and familiarize the readers with is the background, the agendas, the competencies, or lack thereof, the incompetencies of leadership, the incompetencies of being able to manage, cast an appropriate vision, to be prepared to have a prudent and justifiable budget and spending priorities. These are things that if you were around any business, and or if you've managed a business or if you understood business, these are basic principles that right now, you know, from the White House and from Congress, we're not getting any of these things. I have no clue of the 5-year vision of this the leadership of our country.
You mean they don't have a business plan?
They do not have a business plan. I mean, if you were to ask, anybody in Congress, even if you were to ask current speaker, but hopefully she'll be dethroned soon, but if you were to ask Speaker Pelosi about where is the United States going to be 5 years from now, where are we going to be specifically? In your mind, where do you see us? She'd be clueless.
She'd be doing a dance.
If you ask our president, okay, Mr. President, we're doing all of these massive changes with all of this social reengineering you're doing and wealth redistribution. what is your master plan 5 years from now? Now, I think he may know what it is, but I don't think he would be able to share with us very candidly what that is. Because I don't think, in general, American, you know, your average American patriot will necessarily align with his specific vision for our country. So that's pretty dangerous, because when you start any type of you know, any really competent leader who has you know, specific priorities, massive risks, and is trying to supposedly coalesce people around a vision and a direction, the people need to understand what that is. And we just are clueless about that. We're for the most part, we're clueless about who the president is. We're clueless about the people that we continually send to Congress. We're clueless about, for instance, Pete Stark, what his agenda is, what Pelosi's agenda is, what Barbara Boxer's agenda is. Why is that? We constantly vote them in office. So what is where's the disconnect here? And so what I lay out in the book is these are the types of things that we need to consider. Fundamentally, we can call these people in the White House and in Congress. We can call them whatever names we want. We can call them crazy. We can castigate them in whatever ways we want. But the bottom line is, we the people send them there. So the problem is not them, fundamentally. We're the ones who went instantly and selectively insane when we voted for them.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Absolutely.
So,
there you go.
So if you look at the problem, which is we the people, and you look at the irrationality of our voting decisions, then you have to quickly conclude that, well, perhaps these people are just like I was for many, many years, most of my life. I was just completely uneducated. I just didn't understand what was going on.
I think that was
and
most
therefore
of us.
I was voting based upon, you know, a reflex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in my tradition. I was just voting, you know, pulling for the D. I was a, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, born, you know, in that environment and fully indoctrinated in that and all of that. So, you know, and I think for the most part, people who constantly pull for the D or pull for the R, or, you know, if any of us have that kind of reflex, I think that that really portends that we need better, more, and more in-depth education.
That we're not voting based on issue. And there's one line on the back of your book that just absolutely says it all for me as far as your message, and that's what makes it so important. It says here, he confirms that while current party platforms and progressive agendas for health care, education, and abortion have become lofty rhetoric for the Democratic Party, they actually result in debilitating and oppressive social agendas and schemes that only perpetrate further enslavement of the underprivileged and the underserved. And I think that is really the root of the problem. There's so much discussion that the conservative elements, whether, I guess, you know, just throw the Republicans under the bus, you know, the Republicans hate poor people and don't want to help them, and yet you look at what happens when you continually run a nanny state, you just create more dependence.
Well, you know, the proof is in the stats. I mean, if you look at the states and the major cities across this nation that are in the most dire straits economically, where they have the highest percentages of unemployment, poverty, you know, all of those social issues related, those areas are run by Democrats. They traditionally are.
Absolutely. Those are excellent points.
So how did you arrive at that? What was your journey to that conclusion? Because obviously that wasn't part of your upbringing, as you had said. You know, you were automatic pull the D, you know?
Right. So a little bit about my journey. So, born in Hunters Point, San Francisco, raised in San Francisco, went to public schools in San Francisco, went to Woodrow Wilson High School, if you can imagine that, so you're going to know what my education was like.
Uh-oh.
and went to San Jose State. Now, I was a Democrat the whole time, and it was primarily because it was just part of the tradition. When later in life, probably, you know, 10, 12 years ago, I started to think about the the condition of communities of color and poor in particular, and started really to reflect on those, especially in relation to my commitment to Christianity. And when you look at that intently, there are just some things that are very difficult to continue to ignore. When you look at issues like abortion, you look at issues of freedom and liberty, and you look at how the government is essentially using communities of color as political pawns, and in essence manipulating those communities so they can continue to pull reflexively for the D.
And how? And why do you say that?
To me, that's abhorrent. If you look at the social programs, right? You look at issues of welfare and a lot of the social programs that are really purportedly to help the poor. They're programs of dependence. Okay,
yes.
they don't allow. They're really set up to encourage more dependence as opposed to independence.
They keep them right where they want them.
Exactly. And I think that, yes, as a nation, it's a great thing for us to be compassionate and to help people who may find themselves in circumstances. But I think it's cruel and unusual punishment to actually encourage systems of dependence. Let me give you an example. A lot of people don't really understand that because they think, well, the government's just trying to help. So let me give you an example. Let's say you're a parent and you have a son or daughter, and that son or daughter is of age to be able to go out and work, but you say, no, just hang around, you know, mom will take care of you, don't worry about it. And that son or daughter now gets, you know, late 30s, 40. You may think you may be helping that son or daughter, but in reality, what you're doing is you're completely disempowering that person to go out and really become responsible and take care of and become basically all that God intended for them to become. You're actually an impediment to their becoming. You're an impediment to their success.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way, and in that way, I think it's cruel. I think it's not helpful at all, and if anything, it stymies the personal growth and independence of that individual. Now, the reason why the nanny state is such a big issue is because that's exactly what our government does in many cases. A lot of these programs are established, and they're spun like, hey, we're here to help you. We want to give you, in quotes, free money. We want to give you, in quotes, free support. But in essence, what they are is they actually, what I call in the book, throughout the book, I think they institutionalize enslavement of those communities. So it's actually an institutionalized policy that really is strategic in a sense. Started with FDR, perfected with Lyndon Johnson, and it's no longer systems of support. They're systems of dependence. There's a huge distinction between support and dependence. Support is, hey, I'm here to help you if you absolutely need me as a safety net. Dependence is, don't worry about it. We got you. We got your back. Stay on our system. You're good. And I think that although our government may not overtly say that, I think the systems are designed that way. And this is why, as you mentioned it with the stats, this is why, by and large, if you look across the United States, heavily Democratic districts and voting blocks, they are very, very poor and poverty-stricken, and they have been for decades. Nothing has changed. The educational standards haven't changed. The poverty rates haven't changed. Actually, under this administration, the poverty rates have changed. They've changed for the entire United States. And especially for those communities, those poor communities, it's actually gotten worse just in the past 2 years. So this whole notion that the more money we throw at it as a government, we're helping these people. The reality is we're actually harming a lot of these communities. because if you were to help those communities, everybody understands what you need to do to end poverty. It's two basic principles that I think everybody can wrap their arms around and really understand. One is education, and two is employment. If you can solve that riddle, which is very solvable, and I put some ideas in the book, then you show as a government how you're sincerely trying to help people. Now, fast forward to today, when we have a government that actually has more taxation on small and medium-sized businesses, which are the number one employer, especially in economies like what we have right now. And you have more heavy and intensive regulatory apparatus that prevents businesses from starting and or thriving, then you're actually not helping employment. You're hurting employment. This whole stimulus debacle, which I outline as well, did not help our unemployment rate. Our unemployment rate went through the roof, and I documented that thoroughly as to why. I mean, it was a stimulus package with no stimuli. There was nothing in it to actually drive employment. It was essentially payoff for the constituents and the blue states that supported this president. So I think that, you know, when you really put your hands around the just two basic principles for helping the poor, education and employment, and recognize what our government has not done to alleviate those issues, especially the current government, then you see how we've actually been disempowered by this kind of social engineering.
Well,
so that's where I was getting at in the book. Issues like abortion, I mean, that's easy. I don't know if you have time to go into that.
Absolutely. We don't deal, obviously, in the Tea Party, we stick with, the limited government and the fiscal responsibility and all that, but that does not mean that there are not really important social issues out there, and you address a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
So have at it.
Well, you know, a lot of people say, you know, look, I'm a feminist and, you know, whatever. I don't have a moral or biblical compass as it relates to abortion. Okay, that's fine. What about an ethical compass? What about the recognition that, we're supposed to be a nation that encourages liberty and justice for all, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And yet, we have a policy born out of the eugenics movement. Margaret Sanger, which is the mother of Planned Parenthood, was a eugenicist, firmly believed in eugenics. She's also racist. She's also a bigot, and this is just, I'm not calling her names. This is factually proven. If you read her writings, you really understand the history and where she came from. So we actually have policies surrounding abortion that, okay, if you're fine, if you want to, you know, dismiss the biblical or moral issues about it, how does it feel that you support, a racial policy now? This entire policy around abortion was born out of, a racist, bigoted policy, which, by the way, eugenics is one of the primary factors that Hitler used for exterminating 6 million Jews. So you got 6 million Jews, some of the most abhorrent crimes in the history of mankind, basically initiated through this eugenics policy. And now we've got over 50 million kids, unborn kids, that were also exterminated by way of this same abhorrent racist policy. And how does that fit with you? We need to talk about this. Because this is a very serious issue. Now, the reason why I say it's racist and it's actually carried out in a very racist manner today, I'll give you some quick statistics and then we can move on. The reality is that Planned Parenthood, you know, people will try to defend the organization. And they'll say, well, you know, maybe she was a racist, but it doesn't mean that she actually had a strategy to eliminate blacks. Okay, well, let's take a look at the statistics. 94% of Planned Parenthood abortion mills are in African-American neighborhoods. 94%. percent
Holy
by some
cow. Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, now, you can't argue with the numbers.
Well, now you have to look at, okay, maybe it's supply and demand. Okay, well, let's take a look at that. The fact is, African Americans make up 12% of the population. It's a fact. Okay? 94% in African American neighborhoods when 12% of the population is African American.
Wow.
Now, let's take it even further. Only 6%, let's say half of the African American population, are female. Okay? So 6%. No, actually, we need to take it a little bit further. Only 3% are actually of childbearing age, 15 to 44. So you got 3% being the total universe that could be, you know, that could participate in abortive programs. You got 94% of the abortion clinics in African American, in or around African American neighborhoods. How does that make sense?
Wow.
How could you say that that's not strategic?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and so how it's played out so far is African Americans make up over 40% of all abortions. So about 52, 53 million unborn have been aborted. Over 20, 23 million have been African American.
Wow.
So how does that not
Where's the disconnect on that?
When you get to the polls,
and you know that somebody, and that's not, those are not secret issues.
But doesn't that tie into the society as a whole where we're at today, where the most important thing is that we take care of ourselves? We get what we want and what we need. It's self-serving
right.
First.
Yeah, but I would think, okay.
So you know, sorry,
even,
I don't
even
know.
Though, you
we're
know,
stunned.
What's
yeah,
really
it's unbelievable.
What's really surprising is even our most liberal-minded friends may not know about this issue. Excuse me. They may not know and have heard the statistics. And I think even they would be appalled to realize a concerted strategy to reduce or eliminate, strategically reduce or eliminate parts of the population. But yet, we hear this spun from the White House that, hey, this is a good thing for you. To have what women's right to choose, you know, as part of the Democratic policy platform. Now, this was the thing that was really, really glaring to me that had me look at intently at the other issues related to education and employment. But it started with understanding more about abortion, and as a principled person, I could there's no way I could stand for that. It's so counterintuitive to what a principled person, like myself, a principled Christian person, I couldn't stomach it. So I had to, you know, really become more independent in my thinking and look for other candidates that I could support. Now, there's another issue we haven't talked about yet, and that's education. I think that if, you know, the Democrats were sincere about education, they really open that up and provide more choice for parents. We actually had a very, very good school voucher program in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Under
yeah.
President Bush that he started. And I cover this as well in good detail. And, you know, the fact is that 5% of the high school graduates in D.C. at the time, several years ago, were actually college ready, only 5%. They had greater than 50% dropout and et cetera. I mean, the stats were staggering. And President Bush said, you know, we really need to try to reform some education in the District of Columbia. That falls under, you know, since it's right there in D.C., it falls under the purview of the White House of Congress. So Bush established a program called the School Voucher Program, and basically and essentially it allowed children in communities of color to go to other, you know, high schools and other schools that, and really provide the parents choice to take them there. It was a federally funded voucher that was good for the taxpayer because literally it took instead of $18,000 per student at the time, it reduced it to $9,000 and said, okay, if you're participating in the program, we'll give you a $9,000 voucher that you can take to whatever school of choice. And so now you empowered people in lower income and poverty-stricken communities and communities of color to really begin to look for alternative means for educating their children and really break the cycle of poverty within their household. And it was off the charts successful. Every statistical category, every category, 98% were college ready of the kids who graduated. There were no dropouts. I mean, it was just unbelievable, staggering. When President Obama got in office, he agreed. He said, this program is really incredible. But it was coming up for funding last year. And unfortunately, our current president, even though he agreed that the program was incredible and off the charts successful, and saving the taxpayer money, he defunded it. Now, this is an African-American man, right, who purportedly wants to really work closely with African-Americans and especially all communities of color to make sure that there's liberty and justice for all and that there's equal justice, right? And he ends the program. And they ask him why, and he says, well, you know, I think it could really hurt the unions. So we Americans who are awakened, we need to recognize that we have a lot of forces to fight. We saw it here in the last California election, where it's not just principles, it's not just personalities of people, but we have huge influences of unions that are really monopolizing the entire electoral process. Excuse me.
But Kevin, when I get emails from some of the groups here locally that don't agree with us, it's all the corporations are bad. Corporations are keeping people poor. Corporations are the root of all of it, and that the unions are all for the worker.
Right.
So what about that?
Well, you know, and that's a good point. What people have to recognize is that the maximum liberty and freedoms and justice for all comes from our ability to make our own way, to innovate, to become entrepreneurial, to design our own futures. And that requires the capacity to be able to open our own businesses and do our own things and to dream about becoming a large corporation ourselves. If we have an undue influence of unions, that will exacerbate our ability, even as a small business, to grow into a medium-sized and into a large business, because unions will force and mandate certain types of additional cost structures that really put a lid on growth. Now, do unions have their place? Yeah, I think they do. Or they did, certainly, during the Industrial Revolution and those types of things. But we have a pretty aggressive labor board and other mechanisms that we can use to fight any injustices in the workplace. So I'm not sure about the real relevance of unions, especially for state workers and those types of things, and teachers and those types of things at the present time. But that notwithstanding, what people have to recognize is that we have a system, a democratic republic built on the free markets and capitalism. And what that means is we're not to inhibit growth, but encourage growth, because as businesses grow, guess what? They need employees. And as we provide more opportunities for employees to get hired, then we can really do something about the disproportional aspects of poverty that are really hurting communities of color and the poor communities in particular. During the Clinton and Bush administrations, the people who are the poorest really came up the fastest. The poor, percentage-wise, the larger percentage of the poor became middle, were actually allowed to become middle-class citizens during those two administrations. Started with Clinton, with his rollback of some of the taxes, and went further with Bush, And so Bush actually helped, if you really look at the stats, the poor and poverty-stricken communities much more, you know, just because of his tax policies and limited and some of the limits that he put on an overly burdened and regulated environment that encouraged business activity.
So
those are the types of things that really encourage employment is what I'm trying to say. And it's not that government should get involved and try to manage or control private enterprise and the ability to grow and expand for private enterprise. But every time they do, they actually put a lid on what employers would do. Right now, we have over $1.3 trillion, sitting on a sideline, according to some statistics, of companies that actually have money to hire, but they cannot or will not because they're, you know, the uncertain tax liability coming up in 2011 and 12 and so on.
Yeah, you'd be kind of silly with what's hanging. It's like having a piano dangling out of a window. You know, it's not the side not the side of the street you want to walk on.
Right.
I've got another piece of your book here toward the end that really caught my eye too. It said, the truth about our worship of a president is that as the result of one man's personal charm and popularity, we desire to cover up mistakes and make irrational excuses for an entire leadership team.
Yeah, so
that was a fairly sweeping comment there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let me give you a little bit more clarification.
Please.
What I use throughout the book are existing standards for how to assess... excuse me, I got to get something on my throat talking so long, but... how to assess competent leadership. I use Peter Drucker, Stephen Covey, well-known business management leadership type gurus, basically. I use their quotes. And we look at competencies or incompetencies of current president and people, individuals of Congress. Okay, so the reality is great leaders always take full responsibility, full unmitigated responsibility for everything that they do. They do not point to past failures, past administrations. Pat Riley takes over a NBA team, comes on that team. He doesn't say, look, this team was a mess when I got on, therefore you can't hold me accountable for our record this year or next year. He says, look, this is my team. I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and we're going to win. And that's it. Great leaders always look ahead. They never look to cast blame on past administration or other issues. They take full responsibility. What we have now is someone who is not a great leader. He's essentially incompetent in a lot of areas, and I don't mean that disparagingly. I mean that based on the definitions of great leadership. So, you know, this is not I'm not the type of a person that's going to just cast disparaging remarks about our president or about our leadership. The reality is that a lot of these people that we currently have in and around the White House and in Congress, they have never actually worked a job before in their lives. And so therefore, I mean, a private sector job. So therefore, they just, some of these concepts that so many of us take for granted are very difficult for them to really comprehend. And so they just do what they know to do. Since our president is, by his own definition, a Saul Alinsky disciple, and if you're not familiar with Saul Alinsky, he wrote Rules for Radicals, you know, community organizer, basically the blueprint for community organizing. And he was also Luciferian and, you know, all kinds of stuff. That our president is a disciple of his, and he said that was the best training of his entire life. Our president said that. But because those tactics of always pointing to other people and casting dispersions and demonizing certain segments are part of that whole methodology, that's all a president knows how to do. I mean, you know, so that's what we're going to get. The other thing that we see from this president, you know, it's all part of his background, is the propensity to divide and polarize and demonize and all of that at the drop of a dime. And great leadership, great leaders, know that in order to lead a unified body, you've got to get not only vision, purpose, goals, objectives, and those types of things, to get everybody to coalesce around that, but you've got to really unify the entire body and get them all on the same page. You don't unify people by demonizing certain segments of the population. Our president is on record countless times saying, those fat cats on Wall Street, those Republicans, those are your enemies, those people there, the rich here, that this, what is this? Now, he may really feel those things, but as a great leader, a person who is trying to, you know, take the bull by the horns and bring this country together that he promised he would do, this is not the way to do it. This is counterintuitive. It's insane.
It's not
helpful. It's illogical. It's no. Irrational. And you can look in any leadership book. There's none on the earth that would say the way that you bring, you know, a team together is you make sure you polarize them first. I mean, this is just stupid.
So Kevin,
what do you really think?
Tell us what you really think. Hey, can you tell the folks listening, since we're almost at the end of the show, how to get your book, website information, basically all around, how do we learn more about you?
Okay, good. So, a couple things. I would recommend that you go to the website. I have a number of blogs out there. Please read the blogs and provide your commentary on those. The website is, www.instanity.com. And please read the blogs in that. Now, you can order directly from the website if you push the immediate delivery button instead of going to some of the other, you know, of course, you can order from Amazon as well if you want to do that, or Books a Million, or any of the other major retailers. But you can order directly from the publisher. It'll probably come to you faster. And certainly the publisher also has e-book downloads, so you can do it that way as well.
I also know that we'll have four copies of that book at our Monday night meeting, 6 o'clock, Bonneview Baptist Church. And we're in our last 20 seconds. Kevin,
okay.
We got to say bye. We're going to put all your info on the web. Go to ReadingTeaParty.com. You can get all the info there.
Should we have our young guest take us out?
Do it. Go, Nikki.
This has been We the People from Reading Tea Party.
You are on KCNR 1460, Shasta, Reading.